You're listening to Sandy Adams Radio. Pastor Sandy is the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. He's currently teaching through the book of Psalms. The text that Pastor Sandy will cover today is Psalms chapter 73 through 77. Here's Pastor Sandy.
Back to Psalm 74. This is what happened at the Red Sea. The serpent again attacked Israel as the nation passed through the waters, and God did what? He broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces. There was a spiritual battle at the crossing of the Red Sea where God once again defeated the serpent. Follow it so far? Because this is where it really gets strange. Because he goes on and he says, and gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness. What does God do with the sea serpent once he breaks him in pieces? He feeds him to the children of Israel as they wander through the wilderness. And what did the Israelites eat during their wilderness wandering? Remember what the food was called? Manna. And what does the word manna mean? We don't know. You know what manna means? It means, what is it? That's what manna means. What is it? They didn't know what they were eating in the wilderness. Was it sea serpent meat? Maybe. It was nothing like their normal diet because they said, what is this stuff? What is it? Well, it's manna. It's what is it? It's what it is. How ironic, though. Leviathan tries to destroy Israel, but God turns the tables. Satan gets beaten and then eaten. God chops up the sea serpent and he uses the pieces to sustain Israel in the desert. Once again, God gets the last laugh. I hope you're getting that point by now. God always gets the last laugh. Asaph. You know, ancient Mesopotamian folklore speaks of this showdown between God and the sea serpent, where the serpent is cut into pieces and given to God's people as food. It sounds so strange, but it is a common storyline both in the Bible and in extra-biblical sources. The idea gets repeated elsewhere in Scripture as well. Just check out Psalm 89, verse 10. We'll get to it in a few weeks. Now, we think of the Exodus as a battle between Israel and Egypt, but in truth, it was a spiritual battle between God and that twisting serpent Leviathan. There's one certainty. All of this does give us plenty of food for thought. Indeed it does. Well, verse 15 tells us, you broke open the fountain and the flood. You dried up mighty rivers, a reference to the Red Sea. The day is yours, the night also is yours. You have prepared the light and the sun. You have set all the borders of the earth. You have made summer and winter. Notice this, God sets all of the borders, all of the boundaries. He sets days and he sets years and he establishes weather. And God authors latitude and longitude. And God authors the 95-degree summer day and the minus 10-degree winter day. God sets the borders. He decides all these things. Remember this, that the enemy has reproached, O Lord, and that a foolish people has blasphemed your name. O, do not deliver the life of your turtle dove to the wild beast. Do not forget the life of your poor forever. You know, in recent weeks, Israel has been acting very hawkish. But Asaph sees Israel as a defenseless dove, and he prays for God's protection. He says, have respect to the covenant. For the dark places of the earth are full of the haunts of cruelty. Boy, I've been in some of those dark places. They are all the dark places, full of haunts of cruelty. Oh, do not let the oppressed return ashamed. Let the poor and needy praise your name. Arise, O God, plead your own cause. Remember how the foolish man reproaches you daily. Do not forget the voice of your enemies and the tumult of those who rise up against you increases continually. Now, God didn't forget his promises to Israel or the crimes of her enemies. In 735 BC, Babylon, the unconquerable city, or so they thought, was conquered by the Medes and the Persians. And it's interesting, the first decree issued by the Persian ruler Cyrus was to allow the Jews to return home and to rebuild their temple. Here he bemoans that the temple has been burned and destroyed. But God gets the last laugh, Asaph. And in the end, the Jews are allowed to come back and they rebuild what the enemy has destroyed. Once again, God proves faithful. Well, Psalm 75 rewinds 140 years from the period of the Babylonians to another time when Judah was on the brink of battle. On this occasion, the Assyrians were the invaders. It was King Hezekiah and Isaiah who prayed. And in answer to their prayer, in the night, an angel of the Lord came and slew the mighty Assyrian army. The next morning, Hezekiah, he looked over the wall. And there across the battlefield, 185,000 Assyrian troops lay dead. And that's when another Asaph picked up his pen and he wrote, "We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks for your wondrous works declare that your name is near." Remember Psalm 74? The psalmist wanted to know how long it would be for God to judge the wicked. Notice now in Psalm 75, verse 2, God tells him, "When I choose the proper time, I will judge uprightly." How long will it last? God says, in the proper time. He says, I choose these times. I choose the appropriate times. It's not always when we desire, but it's when God knows best. God chooses proper times. He says, the earth and all its inhabitants are dissolved. I set up its pillars firmly, Selah. I said to the boastful, do not deal boastfully, and to the wicked, do not lift up the horn. Do not lift up your horn on high. Do not speak with a stiff neck. You know, since an animal's strength was in its horns, horn in the Bible is used as an idiom for strength. And so here he's saying, don't boast in your own strength. It's as if he's saying, hey, don't toot your horn. You know, don't get haughty here. God is the one who's done these things. And then he says, for exaltation comes neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south. But God is judge. He puts down one, and he exalts another. Here's a wonderful verse. God arranges the pecking order. God is the one who doles out the opportunities and establishes authority and sets a chain of command. Hey, if you're looking for a promotion, the first person you should go and see is God. For promotion, exaltation, comes from God. Notice also by process of elimination, notice God abides in the north. Being a southern boy, it's hard for me to admit this, but apparently it's true. God abides in the north. He says promotion doesn't come from the east or from the west or from the south, but it comes from the north. Evidently, that's where God lives. God came to Job out of a whirlwind that came out of the north. In Ezekiel's vision, the throne of God comes from the north. The sacrifices in the temple were always offered on the north side of the altar, as Leviticus 11 verse 1 puts it, before the Lord. Maybe this is why our compasses always point to true north. Again, as a southerner, it's hard to admit, but God always associates himself with the north. Now, he's going to speak in a southern drawl, I'm sure, but he comes from the north. Verse 8, for in the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red. It is fully mixed, and he pours it out. Surely its dregs shall all the wicked of the earth drain and drink down. This is God's cup of wrath. This is God's cup of judgment. I'll bet you've never heard God referred to as the divine bartender. But that's the picture that we have here in verse 8. God is behind the bar. God is the one mixing the drinks. And understand, he's about to mix a double shot of righteous wrath for the wicked of this world. Next time you're at a party, be careful what you do. Remember, God is the one who ultimately stirs all the drinks. Here he says he pours it out. He pours out his judgment upon the wicked. He mixes the cup. He says, but I will declare forever. I will sing praises to the God of Jacob. All the horns of the wicked I will also cut off. In other words, all their strength I'll cut off. But the horns of the righteous shall be exalted. God is the one who humbles and who exalts. Reminds me of what Jesus said in Matthew 23, verse 12. whoever exalts himself will be abased, but whoever humbles himself will be exalted. The Septuagint, which was a Greek translation of the Old Testament, contains a footnote that dates Psalm 76 also to the time of the Assyrian invasion of Jerusalem in 722 BC, which actually connects it with the previous psalm, Psalm 75. These two psalms go hand in hand. Asaph begins, "In Judah, God is known. His name is great in Israel. In Salem also is his tabernacle and his dwelling place in Zion." The word Salem is short for what word? Jerusalem, right. Mount Zion is one of Jerusalem's five mountains, but it's also the name for the whole city. He says, "There he broke the arrows of the bow, the shield and the sword of battle." Outside the walls of Jerusalem, God delivered his people from the sword of these ferocious Assyrians. You can read about this night of deliverance in 2 Kings chapter 19. The psalmist says in verse 4, "You are more glorious and excellent than the mountains of prey." After the angel slaughter of the Assyrians, they fled, the rest, those who remained, they fled the camp. And they left behind piles, literally mountains, of treasure and supply and gold and silver. They left behind these mountains of prey. Yet in Asaph's estimation, God is more glorious and more excellent than all these stacks of spoils, all these mountains of prey. I hope you've concluded that no amount of blessing can ever compare to the blesser himself. The giver is always more glorious than his gifts. Verse 5, "The stout-hearted were plundered. They have sunk into their sleep, and none of the mighty men have found the use of their hands. At your rebuke, O God of Jacob, both the chariot and horse were cast into a dead sleep." Apparently, God put the Assyrian soldiers into a deep sleep right before he executed them. It was an act of mercy, even in his judgment. It was as if the angel performed sort of a lethal injection on them all. Verse 7, "You yourself are to be feared, and who may stand in your presence when once you are angry?" Did you know God gets angry? Did you know God gets angry with sin? You need to know that. You can get into a lot of trouble unless you know that. He says, "You caused judgment to be heard from heaven. The earth feared and was still when God arose to judgment to deliver all the oppressed of the earth." God judges sin and sinners. It just doesn't always happen when I think it should. Always remember what God says here in Psalm 75, verse 2. "When I choose the proper time, I will judge uprightly." God judges in his time. He says, "Surely the wrath of man shall praise you. With the remainder of wrath, you shall gird yourself. Make vows to the Lord your God and pay them. Let all who are around him bring presents to him who ought to be feared. He shall cut off the spirit of princes. He is awesome to the kings of the earth." Boy, every king needs to be conscious that he also has a king. Every king needs to be conscious of the fact he reports to a king as well. Every president needs to understand that he has an authority to which he is accountable. Well, Psalm 77 is a prophecy given when the Babylonians invaded Judah. We're going back and forth from the Assyrians to the Babylonians. And it asks really the same question as does the book of Habakkuk. Recall the prophet Habakkuk? He was very confused. Here was his problem. Why would God judge his people with a people more wicked than the Jews? I mean, the Babylonians, they made the Jews look like choir boys. And yet God was using them to judge the Jews. Why would God do such a thing? It just didn't make sense to Habakkuk. Again, we clear a huge hurdle in our relationship with God when we realize that his ways aren't always guaranteed to make sense to us. Have you realized that yet? That God doesn't owe you an explanation. He hasn't guaranteed that everything he does is going to make sense to you in your little pea brain. He hasn't limited himself in that way. I learned a long time ago, God has a great curveball. He also has a good changeup. And he's not afraid to throw either of them at any point in the count. I mean, there are times when God deliberately works in ways that don't make sense to me. It's a curveball. Or he'll change it up. And he'll do so to test my faith. Do I trust him when I can't trace him? Can I obey him in the dark? Real faith will always be able to trust God, even in the dark. Do I follow my own sense of reason, or do I trust in God? You've heard me tell the story before, but I think I got time to slip it in. The little boy who was scared of the dark, and one night his mom told him to go out on the back porch and fetch the broom. He said, "But Mom, I can't go out there. It's too dark." She said, "Son, Jesus is with you wherever you go. Go ahead. You can do it." So he goes to the back door. He cracks the door just a few inches, and he says, "Hey, Jesus, if you're out there, how about handing me that broom?" God wants us to be able to trust him even in the dark places. He says in these first four verses, "I cried out to God with my voice. To God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted." Asaph was so distraught he couldn't sleep. "I remembered God and was troubled. I complained, and my spirit was overwhelmed. You hold my eyelids open. I was so troubled that I cannot speak." You ever been so troubled you can't go to sleep? He's saying here that God's taken toothpicks and he stuck them in my eyelids. You know, I just can't get to sleep. "I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. Will the Lord cast off forever, and will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies?" Has God forgot to be gracious? Has he just taken all of his mercy and just put it in a closet and just said, "Enough of that. I'm not going to give him any more"? Boy, the situation the psalmist faces just doesn't fit with his knowledge of God. He knows of God as a gracious God. He says from ancient times, God has been faithful. And yet at this moment, Asaph feels that he's been abandoned by God. You know, there's a great passage from Daniel Defoe's novel, Robinson Crusoe. I'm sure you know the story. A man gets shipwrecked on a deserted island, and in the beginning, Crusoe finds the island to be a tropical paradise. He's very content there. Life is good. Until one day, he makes a discovery that changes everything. Defoe writes, "It happened about noon, going towards my boat. I was exceedingly surprised when the print of a man's naked foot on the shore, which was very plain to be seen on the sand, I stood thunderstruck. I had no sleep that night. And the farther I was from the occasion of my fright, the greater my apprehensions were. Fear banished all religious hope, all that former confidence in God now vanished. I lived 2 years under this uneasiness, which made my life much less comfortable than it was before, all on account of the print of a man's foot, even though I had never seen any human creature come near the island." Now notice, an inexplicable turn of events robbed Robinson Crusoe of his faith and his confidence in God. That mysterious footprint in the sand. What he couldn't explain robbed him of what he knew. And this is where we have to be careful. Because there's things that come up in life that are a mystery to us. And yet there are other things that we know, that we're confident in. We can't let the inexplicable rob us of the known. We have to know who God is. We have to know that we know. We have to believe and trust. And we have to remember that faith doesn't always get a reason. Real faith is faith even in the dark. Notice verse 10, the psalmist says, "And I said, this is my anguish, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds." Once again, remember in the dark what you learned in the light. When faced with what you don't know, hold on. Hold tight to what you do know. Verse 13, "Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary." Here we are again. You got to go into the sanctuary. When you get confused on the streets, you need to head to the sanctuary. You need to hold on the street what you've learned in the sanctuary. Asaph here finds encouragement and comfort and a renewed faith by turning from the situation to God in the sanctuary. Boy, in the street, in the watchtower, among the circumstances, things can look bleak, but in the sanctuary, that's where we get our balance. That's where we get brought back to our foundation. That's where we're reminded in the sanctuary that God is greater than any problem that I might have. And yet someone might challenge that thought tonight. Isn't that a cop-out, Sandy? You're saying when the real world gets tough, we're supposed to escape to the sanctuary. Hey, here's what we need to realize. The sanctuary is the real world. The world we live in is temporary. It's passing away. Trust me, your situation, your circumstances, they're bound to change. But God's promises are going to last forever. The real world is the sanctuary. Here's a good point. Sometimes the spark of faith is slight and does not make the darkness bright. But keep it lit and you will find far better this than being blind. One little flame when all is night proves there is such a thing as light. And faith stays lit in the sanctuary, in God's presence. Verse 14, "You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. You have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you. They were afraid. The depths also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The sky sent out a sound. Your arrows also flashed about." Lightning here is viewed as God's arrows. "The voice of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known." At the crossing of the Red Sea, God's footprints were not known. Israel was trapped between the sea on one side and the charging army on the other side, and Moses had no clue how God was going to save his people. He couldn't see God's footprints. But God was there. And God did save his people. And sometimes you don't see God's footprints, but God is still there. Oftentimes, God doesn't leave footprints. He says, "You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron." And the same is true in our life today. Sometimes we get trapped between a rock and a hard place. We can't figure God out. His footprints are not known to us. But that's where faith kicks in. You need to learn to trust Him regardless. You need to go to the sanctuary. You need to keep that spark of faith lit. Remember, one little flame when all is night proves there is such a thing as light. I pray that your faith will be that proof tomorrow. From March the 10th to the 23rd, I'll be leading a tour to Israel, and we would love for any of our listeners to join us. We'll start at the magnificent theater on the Mediterranean where Paul preached to King Agrippa, and we'll end with worship and communion at the Garden Tomb. In between, it's one exciting adventure after another. Imagine relaxing by the Sea of Galilee one day and floating on the Dead Sea the next, exploring waterfalls in the Golan Heights, and admiring the desert from the top of Masada. We'll spend time in the rock city of Petra and in the holy city of Jerusalem. We'll ride camels, wade through Hezekiah's tunnel, boat across the Sea of Galilee, and study God's word at every turn. Hey, a trip to Israel is like a Bible study on steroids. If you've never been, I encourage you to go. And if you like, you can go with us. Our trip is affordably priced. If you'd like more details, please contact us. Here's Josh to give you that information.
Thanks, Pastor Sandy. Yes, to learn more about this exciting trip, visit sandyadams.org. Again, this amazing trip is taking place March 10th through the 23rd, 2019. We encourage you to contact the church office at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. You can call us at 770-736-2828 or log on to sandyadams.org. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, it's our prayer that you would seek the Lord about joining Pastor Sandy in Israel in March of 2019.